in the effort of getting us going and giving our speaker lots of time, it's my pleasure to be here to introduce her. Soraya Dean, a graduate of Saginaw State College and the Sri Lankan Law College, founder of the Muslim Women's Speakers Movement, and co-founder of Peace Moms, promoting Christian-Muslim dialogue. Organized the first Women's Interfaith Leadership Conference in Los Angeles in 2016. Ms. Dean is visiting Oregon after returning from Nigeria, where she led the opening ceremony of the Omnia Institute for Contextual Leadership and facilitated work on the critical role of women in reconciliation and peacemaking. And I am pleased today to be able to announce and welcome the amazing Soraya Dean.
Thank you, Terry, and thank you, Carlos. To presidents who believe in communication and hearing from Muslims, that gives us hope. Thank you. I believe that we live in a world where 50% of the people have nothing to say but they are speaking. And there's the other 50 who have so much to say but they are not speaking. And hate has gone viral. Hate has gone global. And I'm wondering even whether it is hate towards Muslims or is it hate towards general that's happening in our beautiful country today? Because even as I speak to you, I think there is a Senate Bill 479 calling for the ban of Sharia. And I read yesterday in the newspapers how an Iranian man who lives in Portland, his house was vandalized and there was graffiti that said, "Go home, terrorists." And these conversations we have are critical to address those vital issues. Because Napoleon once said, religion is a powerful tool for people who rule, and it's a very useful tool to keep people quiet. So I think in this great nation of in the United States, we shall not, and we will not let religion divide us. So in order for us to not to do, thank you. How can we not do that? We have to be in a continuous state of communication, curiosity, and inquiry. The question we ask in the Muslim world is, are the American Muslims being included or are they going to be excluded in the conversation? And I said, and I wrote even to the President of the United States, I said, talk to us, not talk about us. And that is a universal truth. We don't need to have a PhD to recognize this, even in our homes, in our communities, in our workplaces. It is that silken thread that can bind us, and that is, it is our ability to communicate with one another. And as an expert in nonviolent communication, I go a step further to speak in a way that is compassionate. And how can we do that? There is a process, and today, more than ever, we have to commit to that process. About 4 weeks ago, I was invited to speak at my daughter's school. Now, she attends a Spanish immersion, Carlos, and she's extremely fluent in Spanish. In fact, she has surpassed the native Spanish speakers. She's an avid reader. So it was Diversity Day celebration. Now, we are seated in the front row, and the event is to begin at 7 o'clock, and it's 6:50. My daughter comes running, and she asks me, "Mommy, how long is your speech going to be?" And I say to her, "Maybe 10, 15 minutes." And she said, "Can you keep it shorter?" And I said, "Yes, I will try." And then she asked me, "And those jokes that you tell, Mommy, please don't tell them, because my friends might not laugh at those jokes." So there I was, my ego bruised a little. But I shared that with you to let you know that even though I might have a little uncertainty about what I should speak, I have utmost certainty about how I feel today. And I want to thank Springfield and Eugene for coming together and creating this space so that a Muslim woman's voice is being heard. And I thought I came here to represent my community, but I feel today that I'm also representing Oregonians, because I have emails from Los Angeles. What is this bill that is happening in the legislature? And they want to know, why was that house vandalized? So this really clearly proves to us that whenever an extreme fraction does something which we have no idea of, which we don't lend any support to, we have to be responsible to respond to that. And that is what brings me to Oregon. I respond to the fear and the smear of the Muslims today. And it is a very serious issue, because I feel hating, and it was Dr. King who reminded us, I stand with love, hate is too much of a burden to bear. I think we all must take a unified step towards loving one another. And thank you. And where else would my story be possible other than in the United States of America? An immigrant, a Muslim, a woman. And where else would it be that in a lunch hour between 12 to 1 that people would flock to this auditorium just to listen to a woman? And therefore, I will never lose hope in this magnificent country that has taught me, and I live by that motto, E pluribus unum. Because we recognize the fact that what happens to one affects us all. So from my heart again, thank you so much for being here. And I'm not saying there is no problem for us to be concerned about. I'm not saying that. There is. There is an extreme ideology that is happening. And most people who have been victims of ideology have been Muslims. The people mostly killed have been Muslims. So what I'm saying is, let us not deny the problem, but let us affirm the solution. That is how we can get over a problem. So what is the great challenge for us as a community today is that we are called to take vicarious liability for actions that are happening elsewhere in the world. And that is hard. I can't even take liability for the way my 17-year-old son drives his new car. It's hard. So it's a very challenging place to be for us Muslims. Patriotism is questioned. We hear again and again, Muslims don't love America. They are terrorists. And if I have to prove one thing to you, I will stand on my head to say that it is not true. Because I live within the community, I work within the community, and I travel across the United States. So this is another challenge that we face. It is also said that we are here to subvert the Constitution. And let us be really clear. If there is a bill in Oregon that says prohibit Sharia law, a lot of misinformation has gone into this particular bill. Because what we hear is that we are trying to subvert the Constitution. And the Muslims in America are under 2%. And this is, hypothetically, dreamingly, imaginatively, it's an impossible allegation. And we say we are here to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. And then it is also said that we support terrorism. So when all these things are said, it's an enormous task for us to come together and say, refute these allegations every day. I am looking for a world where we will open the newspapers and our political leaders would have said something so profound that we can all have a smile. Now, is it that not possible? It is if we want to unite people together. So call me an idealist, but I think if we continue to do the work we are doing, because evil prevails when good people do nothing. I think we can come to a time where we can see that happen. So who are the Muslims? Who are the Muslims? Did they just come to America after 9/11? Where were they? So there is, I mean, in 1539, we have proof that there was the first Muslim who came to the United States of America. And we have ample documented proof that Muslims were slaves, about 10 to 50%. So because of the position they were in and the treatments they received, they did not openly proclaim their faith. They practiced the religion in private. But they did. They followed certain the rules and the practices that were really common to Muslims. And today, I don't know if you know, about 40% of Americans who are Muslims are African Americans. It's a large constituency. Even we didn't know that until after 9/11 and when things happened. And then Islam and the Muslims are the most diverse religious community. As the founder of the Muslim Women Speakers Movement, when I take groups of women, we go to churches, synagogues, associations, organizations like this, and we share our stories. Because we believe we are in a very challenging place. The policies might not change, but we believe that our stories can. And as the founder of the Muslim Women Speakers Movement, that was my goal, that my story can change one person's heart. So we understand, we need to tell America and the world that the Muslims in America are the most religiously diverse group. So, and most of us are first generation. How many of you know a Muslim here? Oh, okay. And of course now everybody does. I am a Muslim woman. Yes, so this diversity is a gift and it's also a challenge. Because we bring so much of our culture, we are trying to find our ways, we bring our practices, and then we are not as organized as we should be. So because most of us are first generation Muslims. So the challenge is there, and together I feel we have to work towards a solution. Because accusing American Muslims of being terrorists and asking them to take vicarious liability for the actions of terrorism outside of the United States is not fair, and it is wrong, and it is a preponderance of such great magnitude, I can't even begin to visit that possibility. But we are trying in the best possible way. There is even a website called MuslimCondemn.com. So we condemn and we stand by to protect the safety of the United States of America. So what can we do? What can we do? I think today more than ever, we have to be very mindful of our communication, because words have power. It can unite us or it can divide us. So when we see things happening, one of the things that debilitates us as human beings and as a community is the judgment, the blame, and the shame. So as a teacher of nonviolent communication, I think we have to learn to make observations versus judgments. It was Krishnamurti who said, the highest form of intelligence is to observe without judging. So those are daily practices that I practice myself. Because I say today, moral outrage, yes, but not personal anger. Because as people who work in the community to transform our communities, when we carry personal anger, we can't do the work we are truly called to do. We will not see the transformation we want to see. And we will not function and thrive as we are meant to be. So who am I, this woman talking to you in a sari? About 15% of Muslims in the world are from the Middle East. Just 15. But they drive the conversation. The rest of us are from South Asia and other parts of the world. So I was born in Sri Lanka. How many of you know where Sri Lanka is? Oh, nice. Okay. Sometimes I have to say it's not going to India and making a right. So my father had a phenomenal influence in my life. He was the kind of person who would wake up every morning and the first question he would ask is, what can I do today to help somebody? An interfaith dialogue was a childhood norm in my home. And as a mother and an interfaith activist, I'm just working so diligently to really share this message with mothers particularly. Because what happens is when we try to correct from the outside, heal from the outside, what is already broken on the inside, that takes a lot of work. And it was Horace Mann who said, we can't repair older men, but we can build strong kids. So teaching these lessons I learned when I was growing up in Sri Lanka. And to this date, of the many lessons my father taught me, there's one particular lesson I really hold strong to as a spiritual practice every day. That is the story of the two farmers. There were two farmers. Farmer number one went to the chicken coop. They were chicken farmers. And he would bring the chicken eggs home every day. He ate some, he sold some, he shared some, and he saved some. And farmer number two, what did he do? He went to the chicken coop and he picked up the chicken poop. And he brought this home every day. And gradually his home began to stink and he himself began to stink. So my father would always say, every morning when you wake up, the first question you need to ask is, are you carrying the chicken poop or the chicken eggs? And that's a profound place for us who are activists. And I don't even call ourselves simply as activists. We are advocates. And activism is a part of our advocacy. Because it's not about us coming together, hearing a message, going home, feeling good. We have to do something more today. It is a defining moment. It is a defining moment for me when my 7-year-old son, I had just driven to pick him up from school on September 11th, 2007. That afternoon, as I parked the car and waited for my son came out of his school. He was crying. And as I lifted his heavy bag, I asked him, is everything all right? And my 7-year-old son, he looks up at me and he asked me, Mommy, are we terrorists? And that was a defining moment for me in my life. A defining moment for Gandhi was when he was riding a train with a first-class ticket in a first-class compartment, he was told he couldn't ride that. He couldn't ride in that compartment. And then Gandhi said, no, but I have a first-class ticket. To which the conductor said, no, but you are colored. You have to go to the back of the train. And when Gandhi refused, he was grabbed by his shoulders and shoved out of the moving train. That was a defining moment in his life. He said he was angry, he was humiliated, and he felt so defeated. And that day he realized he was going to fight to work for equality in a non-violent way. So there are defining moments all around us. And I think today it is a defining moment in our country. Are we going to let hate divide us? Or are we going to heal our country? Because it is not what others do, I come to realize. It's what we do that can bring about that heal. Because oftentimes we point fingers and we don't realize that three fingers are pointing back at us. So the defining moment for us is to rise above our general being and become conscious beings about what is happening around us. Because let us never forget that what happens to one of us definitely is going to affect all of us. And when I go back from Portland, from Oregon, visiting all these beautiful countries, every one of you have impacted my life in a great way. Those are the stories I'm going to share. Not about the Senate bill that's pending or not about the incident that happened in Portland. Those things will continue to happen. But for me, building a relationship with you, telling you my story, taking the tough questions from you so that we can stay in a conversation, not just to heal ourselves, but to heal our planet, and so that we can really raise strong kids. because our children deserve better. As a mother, it stirs me deeply about, we are so mindful about the legacy we are going to leave, but not the legacy we are going to live. Yes, this is something we have to wake up every day and ask. When I first came to the United States 18 years ago, I didn't know a soul. And there was a woman in Michigan who drove 3 hours to pick me up. She was my brother's friend. And that afternoon, as she took me to her house, she didn't just provide me a place to stay. She provided me a home to thrive. And she asked a simple question. She asked every day, "What can I do for you?" And I think it'll be a fabulous question we all need to ask each other about, what can I do for you? So I want to take a moment and turn to the person next to you, behind you, and will you please introduce yourselves?
This is KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. We're on Facebook and Twitter and online at klcc.org.
Thank you so much. So like my friend Sherry asked 18 years ago, what can I do for you? I met a brother from another mother in Los Angeles. He was somebody who belonged to the City Club of Bend. And I was talking to him about the challenges we are facing as a community and three things that's happening to us. We are being isolated, we are being abandoned, and we are being shamed. And I think those are three emotionally charging it's an emotionally debilitating place for us to be as a community. My children wake up almost every day and they ask me, "Mommy, why do they hate us so much?" So we don't even watch news anymore. So David Russell, when he came back, he said, "I want you to come to Bend." And he arranged for me to come to Bend. And from Bend, it went kind of not really viral, but it went to all the city clubs. And city clubs, you do such phenomenal work, and thank you for being there, doing that, and coming here to attend every meeting despite your busy schedules. I mean, just do it, because people like you, I mean, the work you do is what gives us hope. So that day, David asked again, "What can I do for you, Soraya?" And I think that is a question that we must continue to ask, because the situation is grave. Every American Muslim is called to be perceived as an enemy. And I think we have to speak into that narrative. And I know my time is catching up. So what do I live by is something I want to share. And also before that, Islam, it was a religion that that happened in the 14th century after Christ. And then there was a time when the Arab world was number one in many things. These are some of the inventions. Anybody here seen this exhibition, 1001 Inventions? Google it, please. And this was a traveling exhibition. It goes from city to city. Perhaps we can bring it to Eugene or Portland. It was beautiful. In LA, we had it for 3 months at the Science Center. It talks a little bit about the Muslims and Islam. It is not a cult as it's perceived. It's a religion to 1.7 billion people in the world. And then the Quran, it's like the book, the Bible and the Torah, revealed to the prophet. Yes. So I want to finish with the message that I hope you will share and you will accept. We are eternally, life is such that we are in a problem, we are coming from a problem, or we are going to a problem. That's not going to change. But it is our personal commitment to really recognize the greatness within us that can make a difference. Scientists have found out that the chance that every one of us are born the way we are with this particular DNA is 1 in 4 billion. They have studied, put us against famine, wars, violence, all kinds of natural and man-made hazards. So it's 1 in 400 billion chances. So I think we must live to our fullest. Horace Mann once said, we should be ashamed to die until we have made a major contribution to this world. And I take that really personally because there are some issues in my community too. It's not perfect. I struggle with the patriarchy. I struggle with the misogyny, which has to end. In fact, I am happy to report that on the 14th of April, I will be leading a mixed gender congregational prayer at a women's mosque in San Francisco. Wow. Yes. Thank you. So I am a feminist, and I stand here because I see so many things that we need to do that is not being done. So living life to our fullest potential is necessary. And then live love. Love is not just one action. It is a series of continuous action that we do for one another. And as we move forward in the current circumstances that we see, it is really necessary for us to look at the world as it could be. Because if we look at the world as it is very scaring, right? We have to hold a vision, but to look at the world as it could be so that it can become what it should be. And then I want to talk about, when you talk about love, it is the only authentic expression of our fullness. And believe me, we can never love the other person unless we forgive. Until we forgive, there are going to be blocks. So when we have to take an inventory of whom are we holding grudges and do some spiritual cleansing in order that our work is a light to the world. It's a light to the world. And then giving. Mother Teresa said, service begins when convenience ends. I think our ability to wake up every day and see, feel something that needs to be done has to be done. Because for us to say, oh, all is fine, is not good. Nothing is fine. We have to make it better. We have to make it great. Because by 2050, we will have 10 billion people in this planet. 10 billion people. The first billion was recorded in the 1800s. It took about 130 years for the next billion. Then another 80 years for the third billion. Thereafter, every 12 to 15 years, we are having a billion people. By 2050, our children won't be interested in these things that divide us. They will be struggling for resources. So how can we provide that to them is something that I think of. And our children might not even live where we were born and raised. I mean, already my children are here and I am here. I don't know whether they will remain here. So there will be so much movement and people are going to be everywhere. We are going to go more global. So we have to really make the place better so that we give our children a better world to live in. And we have a choice. There is a story where Dr. King was once at a meeting and somebody came up to him and asked, "Are you king?" And Dr. King looks up and says, "Yes, I am king." This person takes a mouthful of spit and spits it at Dr. King. Dr. King reaches for a handkerchief. He wipes the spit and he says, "Here, this belongs to you." Yes. So no matter what happens, we are fabulous beings. We have a choice. And this is the choice that I celebrate because I don't know what it is to be afraid. Fear is not a part of my life. And I visualize yourself as in a chariot. The rider is your mind. Okay? And the four horses are your senses. We get to control it. Because what we do habitually is we embrace a certain thought, we have a certain feeling, then we have a certain thought, we have a certain feeling. This is a cycle that we repeat. How many of you know how many thoughts we have in a day? About 90,000. That's a lot. Even as you're listening to me, you're thinking, right? What is she saying? Does it make sense? Who is she? So these are thoughts. So, and of the 90,000 thoughts, about 70% is negative. So our ability to control those thoughts, control our emotions, control what comes out of our mouth is very important to make observations versus judgments. And I want to finish with the story of the mousetrap. Okay, if there was a farmer who had a pesky mouse, so he goes and brings a mousetrap. The mouse sees this and he gets really desperate and he goes to the chicken and he says, "Chicken, chicken, please help me, he has brought a mousetrap and I'm going to die." The chicken says, "You know what, I am too busy, this won't affect me, go be safe." So then the mouse is really desperate, more desperate, he goes to the pig. "Pig, help me." And the pig is too busy. He says, "You know what? My food is all secure. I'm outside. I don't even come inside. This is your problem." And then the desperate little mouse goes finally to the cow. And he says, "Cow, please help me." And the cow again, "You know what? I eat grass. I don't even go in. This is your problem. Take care of it." So one day, a little snake gets caught into the mouse trap. And immediately, the farmer's wife goes past it and the snake stings the farmer's wife. She falls ill. A group of people visit the farmer and they say, "My goodness, she is so weak. Do you know that chicken soup is good in times like this?" So he makes chicken soup. The farmer makes chicken soup. And then she doesn't get better. Another group comes and says, "She has lost so much weight. She's so weak. Why don't you feed her some pork? She's going to get put on some weight." So there goes the pig. And then the cow, the farmer is now depleted all his resources. He's poor, he has no money, so he has to sell the cow to make some money. He wants to sell some meat, so he slaughters the cow. So the moral of the story is, of course, as you must very clearly have got it, that what happens to one affects us all, and we must stand up strong and bold when communities are put down, when communities are blamed and shamed. And I look to you, and I know you're doing so much work, but I invite you to do more. Thank you. Oh, questions, okay.
Thank you, Soraya. My name's Len Goodwin. We will, as the City Club's tradition, have a period of questions, and as Eugene does so often, we will start with a first question. In this case, we've asked the Reverend Dan Bryant to come and ask that question. While he's coming down, though, I feel the need to tell you a personal story, which relates to some of the things that Soraya has said, particularly about Sharia. If you have read the New York Times recently, you saw an article about in Brooklyn, in Borough Park. There were two pizza stores right next to each other across the street, both owned by extremely religious Orthodox Jews. They had a dispute. One was claiming that the other was just in business to try and drive him out and get customers away from him. So what did they do? As is the custom with Orthodox Jews, they took it to a court called a Beit Din. A Beit Din is a court that enforces halacha, which is the very Orthodox religious law that is followed by a number of Orthodox Jews. That court, after extensive hearings, decided that, in fact, one of the businesses had intended to offend and degrade the other business and rendered its judgment. That judgment had absolutely no effect. It was a religious court. It was not empowered to enforce law, but it was empowered to enforce religious law. And that offending pizza owner had a choice. He could comply with what his religious court said, or he could ignore it completely and, you know, if the other one wanted to file a case in civil court, he could file a case and, you know, so what would happen? I give you that example because that is really what Sharia means. Sharia is religious law. It is not the law of the land and never will be, at least not in the United States. Yet we have this fear of it because it's different. Do we have the same fear of Orthodox Jews who enforce their version of the Torah with their own courts out of sight of civil courts? I suggest not. Dan?
Thank you, Len. That's kind for you to clarify that point. Thank you.
Thank you, Soraya, so much. It's just an absolute delight to hear you speak. I think one of the things that I hear from so many people in our community is just a sense of despair of what they see happening. We can date it back to many things, but certainly with the election and different things and the way people have been acting out of their fears of people of color or of different religions. And, yeah, we hear all these stories of people being told to go back home where you came from, even though they were born in this country, raised in this country, the kinds of way that people have been mistreated. We've heard stories in our own community, for instance, of Hispanic children who have been accosted on the street, on their way to school, in school, that kind of thing. So I'm looking for some hope, and maybe because I'm a preacher that, I want to hear hope. And I'm wondering, what are the stories that you have that would give us hope that we can overcome these fears, that we truly can create a society that is welcoming and doesn't just tolerate diversity, but embraces it, welcomes it, that this is the strength of community. Mm-hmm. So if you can provide us one or two stories that are really those examples that give you that kind of hope, I'd appreciate that.
Okay. One is, of course, traveling through all the city clubs who want to hear my story so that we know stories can transform lives. That is a story. That is a story that I would like to lead with. Secondly, recently there were a lot of Jewish synagogues being vandalized, cemeteries, and there were a group of Muslims who came and raised thousands of dollars to really repair that. That is a story of hope. And then when you look at in the area of sports, you know, that can unite us. We have some positive stories of where we have American Muslims who represent United States of America at a world level. That is a story of hope. And then I think the greatest hope is that the little acts of kindness that we afford to each other, showing up, supporting one another, listening to one another. And for me, my story is hope. For me to be doing a tour like this, when there's so much fear, and when you think that narrative needs to be interrupted by listening to the other person, that is hope by itself. So I've seen thousands of people taking personal responsibility for the community that and for and on behalf of Muslims. That is hope. And then I forgot to mention is also that social media, our ability to engage social media is critical in this time, posting something positive because people are reading. And then to really recognize the fact that we have a problem, because lots of people don't realize that it is a problem. So, stories, everyday stories. Is that which will give us hope.
Take questions from the audience. Carolyn Miller is on this side with a microphone, Sandy Erickson on that side. If you'll just raise your hand. Carolyn, I'll go to you first, and then Sandy, and we'll take some questions.
Hi, I'm Ida Keir, Eugene City Club member, and I'm wondering how your children and their peers are dealing with all of this. I mean, it's a very frightening time for adults and probably even more so for children. And how is your generation or your peers engaging with them?
Mm. It is a very challenging many ways, but it is also called us to a new level of engagement and activism. So my son, who is 17 now, I took him to 19 bar mitzvahs. And any Jewish people here? Okay. So he said, Mommy, I want to become Jewish. So being engaged is something that we have taken very seriously. And I think it has to come from both sides. I was in Bend, and I went to the Bend High School. They had 1,200 students, and they had not known a Muslim. So the community is so small. And I was at the church on Sunday, and they preached about the Gospel of John, where a man is blind, and somebody asked Jesus, "Why am I blind? Did I do something wrong, or did my parents do something wrong?" And Jesus' response was profound. I learned a lot that day, that what he said was, this brokenness gives you to be godly. How do you respond to that? So I think if we all take that message very seriously, how can I bring hope to this? As a Muslim, as a secularist, as an atheist, as an agnostic, as a Jew, because this is not a time for us to be divided by religion. So, Los Angeles is a model city for interfaith dialogue. When I go back on the 2nd of April, we are hoping to gather 1,000 people, and we're going to do an interfaith rally. We will begin at the synagogue, go to the church, and culminate at the mosque. So really, being on the ground, boots on the ground, is critical. Yes. And creating tribes. Tribes. Carlos, you want to know what we could do? Tribes. How many of you watched the movie Pray the Devil Back to Hell? Okay, it's the Liberian peace activist who finally won the Nobel Prize for Peace. What she did was amazing. She got women. She created her tribe, of course, because they were being hounded by the government and the rebels. They had nowhere to go. She said, we lost everything. There was nothing to lose. So they gave their physical bodies. And that's what even Gandhi said, you know. You have to show up for the cause. So what they did was they found thousands of women who would really go and block these buildings where men were entering into peace negotiations. And if no clear, strong peace accord was reached, they would not let the men go out of the room, out of the building. They blocked it. Yes, they blocked it. And gradually, men knew. They were compelled. And there was a tool they used. Some women even withdrew sex from their spouses. So it was to that extent they were invested in the transformation. Finally, now Liberia has a woman president. And Limo Bowie, she won the Nobel Prize for Peace. And it was profound. And in America, we are so blessed in so many ways. We don't have those on-the-ground struggles. I mean, I went to Nigeria and I saw extreme poverty. I saw the way the women were treated. They didn't even know the meaning of the word hope. They had reconciled to the fact that this is God's provision to me. And I'm going to pray every day to change it. Whether the change came or not, they couldn't change anything. They were reconciled to where they were. But in America, we have, I mean, profound opportunities. And I am so grateful for this country. As an immigrant, it has really given me the opportunity to raise my voice without fear.
I really want to thank you for empowering me and many women just with your initial statement of being in this country, being able to speak as a woman, reminded me of the female history way back and how far we've come. I found that so encouraging. My question is, since we're all here and we're wanting to help in many, many ways, where do you get your courage?
Where?
Yes, what is the source of your courage?
Oh. I personally, I think it was my childhood. That's why as a certified nonviolent parent educator, I believe a lot of the brokenness happens in our homes. When Mother Teresa was awarded the Nobel Prize for Peace, she was asked, what message do you have? She said, go home and love your families. So as a certified parent educator, I think we have to create that space in our homes. And I had a very strong, loving childhood, which is really helping me to this date. Because when our children hear one thing negative, they have to hear 15 positive things to counter that negative. And it's the same with our adults. It's not different. We are human beings. My courage comes from the fact that I'm Eastern, and then I am, part of me belongs there. I take the best from there, and I take the best from here. I merge it. And then also, I mean, you. It's you. This story is not about even me. It's about you who are giving me the space to thrive, to speak. It's you. Thank you.
I have a daughter named Soraya.
Oh.
Spelled different. I just want to applaud you for what you're doing, because I'm a Muslim too, and I have lived in this country for 47 plus years, and I've seen the ebb and the tide of especially since 2011, where hate crimes and similar feelings became more apparent and bubbled to the surface. I wanted to comment about the hope thing. I think the interfaith that you're speaking about also gives us hope. And there is also here in our own town a church that Reverend Dan Bryant runs that comes together every 11th of the month, where many people of different faiths come and speak about a topic from their faith tradition. So Dan gives us hope right here in town. I want to acknowledge that. And I also would like to comment about the fact that I think one of the issues that we vicariously, but not so vicariously, have to deal with when we're living here is being perceived as people who need to become part of the melting pot without a second hand meeting us. It's like trying to clap with one hand only. So the lack of understanding of Islam and Muslims and their cultures, and the fact that they live in 56 different countries, and they're not all cookie cutters. And the fact that they can disagree and fight amongst themselves and purge and evolve, it's just natural, normal. Christianity went through that, Judaism, cultures that are non-religious went through that, but we are denied that right. It's like, why do you guys fight? Well, stuff happens, you know. It's on a bumper sticker, right? So it is a part of our evolution. And as you mentioned clearly, that most people that are hurt by the extremists are Muslims. And also that's equally important to bring up is that most of the people that are fighting against ISIS are also Muslims. And if action speaks louder than words, for those that want us to stand up and vicariously condemn those extremists, look at our action. We're fighting against them. We're giving our daughters and sons' lives to fight against the extremists. And I appreciate very much the gentleman that clarified the Sharia law, the fear. We are fighting against fear all the time. I don't expect to be embraced and loved in this community, though I've been in it for 47 years, because before I'm embraced, I need to be not feared. So it's at least a two-step process. And I cannot do the other one by myself. You have to give me a chance. You have to hear me out. You have to judge me for my action, not by what you see on your television set. So you folks have a responsibility to me as I have a responsibility to you. Judge me by my action, who I am, not by what those extremists do. And finally, a question. Thank you for allowing me to say that. I know. How many more of you are there? And can we Xerox you? Can we make lots of copies of you? Because we need that understanding is lacking in this country. Thank you.
Thank you for saying that. Yes, there's not one Islam and there's not one Muslim. That is what is being said, and that is totally incorrect, and it doesn't serve anybody to walk with that mindset. And I want to slightly allude to the Sharia, because Sharia is only about 6% of the Sharia is in the Quran. Rest of the Sharia is man-made. It was all put together and implemented by tribes and nations about 50 years after the Prophet died. So if it is a Sharia really means, it's not a law, it means the way. So in Sri Lanka, women drive. There's no Sharia where women can't drive. In Saudi Arabia, there is a Sharia that says women can't drive. So it varies from country to country, from tribe to tribe, from community to community. And same with Iran, you know. My sister-in-law went to Iran and she was given a head covering in the airplane. And she was forced to wear. And that talks volumes for the way the women are treated in that part of the world. But it is their Sharia. It is not the Sharia. So when someone says, you know, the Sharia is coming to overtake us, which Sharia? Because in Oklahoma, there was a case that was filed to prevent Sharia in that state, and the Supreme Court said, we can't adjudicate on something that's not there. So same will happen in Oregon, I'm sure. But to the extent we have to go to prove that is very sad. And there are women like me, and I want to come back. I have groups of women. We travel together. We tell our stories. We talk about our struggles, and we want to create bonds and build bridges with each other. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Debbie Lehman, and I don't know much about the Muslim community in the Eugene Springfield area, and I'm just wondering if you can tell us a little bit about it and who we contact if we want to start building bridges, like getting kids of different religions together and creating social events, and just something concrete that we can do to start the process.
Thank you. I think the community is really little, 0.0%. But I'm going to do some research, and I will write to Len so that he can... Are you a member of the club? Oh, okay. I can send it to him.
We can post it on our website.
Okay. And I want to ask a favor of you. I just don't want it to be where I came, I spoke, we listened. I want to create a movement. I want 1,001 letters from Oregon about meeting me and how we can all come together to promote love and dispel hate, because hate debilitates us. We have to realize, you know, Buddha once said, drinking poison and waiting for the, it's like wait, and hate is like drinking poison and waiting for the other person to die. So when we are afraid, when we have hate, it impacts our physicality. So I'm thinking, when I have your letter, somebody else will hear about it and they will write a letter. So let us come together, because I have now spoken to over 600 people in Oregon. And I thought how wonderful it would be if I could bring these letters and then go to another state and speak about my experience. And in my own little way, if I can create that collective consciousness, because we can't give up until we have created that collective consciousness. And if you know the 100 monkey story, it was an experiment that was done in Stanford. The first monkey was given potato with sand and he threw it. The second, fourth, 10th, 20th, the 90th monkey also threw the potato. But when it came to the 100th monkey, he wiped the potato and he ate it. Thereafter, every monkey began to wipe the potato and eat it. So as social activists today, we have to build that momentum, keep that hope and keep that work going until we come to the 100th person. That's my email, info@sorayadean.com. And I would love to hear from you. Thank you.
Well, you pretty much asked my question. I'm so grateful for you to come here. I'm grateful for the meeting on the 11th so we can get to know each other. I am looking for ways to interact with people of that are different from me. And here is a start, because we need to make more tribes. So I'm not sure I really have a question, except how do we encourage each other? How do we find each other? And you may not know that, but that's what I need to know.
Like for instance, I think for Muslims, Ramadan is around the corner in May, and that's a time for a lot of community building. If you know where the Islamic Center of Springfield is, I don't know. I didn't find out. Perhaps you can reach out, because this is a huge problem in my community. We are not activists, all of us. We are not really awakened to the fact that there's a problem, because most of the Muslim women are first generation. They're struggling between raising their kids, staying home, and they don't see the broader picture. So so it's like in my faith, there is a saying, each one of you is responsible for 70 people in your community. I think that's a powerful standard to go by. And then, you know, the Good Samaritan rule, you know, it's not asking what will happen to me, but asking what will happen to the other person if I don't do what I need to do. So really, I think I ask, really, if you would reach out, that will be helpful. Because I see also in my community, people are withdrawing. They're afraid, you know, and that is not a good sign.
My name is Jim Stauffer. I work with the local chapter of a national organization called League of United Latin American Citizens. It's a civil rights organization. And I'm making more of a statement than asking a question. And I know in this audience there's members of other civil rights organizations from the local area here. And this is the time when we all need to be reaching out to the small Muslim community here in Eugene. You know, we're living in dangerous times now. At 9/11, I lived in California, and it was the same thing. Afterwards, a coalition of us got together and reached out to the rather large Muslim communities that were there in the Bay Area. And they were really receptive to it. They were really appreciative. It helped bring them out because they were sort of hunkering down and, you know, hiding a little bit. And really bringing it out, you know, when you get to know people, you don't fear them as much. And so I'm going to ask people here in the audience that do belong to other civil rights organizations, you know, this is the time to reach out to our neighbors and to work together.
And sometimes it could be a simple post on Facebook or Twitter. That's the beauty of the world we live in, you know. From our garage, we can make change. And knowing where the people who don't mix well, like who have this issue of fear of the Muslims, you must know those pockets. How can we go there? And how can we do an interfaith program there? Because I'm kind of wondering whether I'm preaching to the choir here. Because you get it, yes. So how can we really go beyond